My name? Ben C. Steele, 2425 Cascade, Billings, Montana, 59102.
Mr. Steele, where were you born?
Roundup, Montana.
How big a town?
Oh, it's about 2,000.
And who were your parents?
My parents was Elizabeth G. McCleary, was my mother's maiden name, and Benjamin C. Steele, Sr.
And what did they do for a living?
We ranched south of Muscle Shell, which is about 26 miles east of Roundup. We had a cattle ranch.
Where did you go to high school?
I went to high school in Billings, Montana, senior high school.
And did you graduate from there?
Yes.
Did you go right on to college?
No.
Were you drafted?
No, I went out and worked on ranches until I joined the military.
So you joined? You weren't drafted?
No. No, I joined before the conscription in 1940. I joined October 10th, 1940.
And where did you go for your training?
I went to Marchfield, California. And I joined the Army Air Corps.
How long were you in training?
How long was I?
California.
I was there about a year. And then I went from there to Albuquerque, New Mexico, where I was assigned to the 19th Bomb Group, which was a B-17 outfit.
And where did you go from New Mexico?
I went from Albuquerque to the Philippines in October of 1941.
And what did you do in the Philippines once you got there?
I was, before the war, I was operations, control tower, and flight plans for airplanes. And I was training to be a gunner at the time the war started out, because there wasn't room for me in operations over at Clark Field.
Any special memories of your time in the Philippines?
Oh, I wasn't there long enough to really to know much about the Philippines. I got into Manila once before the war started, because it was just 6 weeks prior to Pearl Harbor.
And where did you go from there?
From Clark Field, we went into Bataan. That's because the war started on December the 8th over there. You know, that it was a day later in the Philippines, because we're on the other side of the line. And we stayed at Clark Field until we were bombed the same day as Pearl Harbor. And we stayed at Clark Field until Christmas Day of 1941, when the Japanese invaded the Philippines, and we were forced into Bataan. And we didn't have any airplanes left, because we lost them all the first day of the war. And so they put us all in the infantry. And I fought on Bataan during the entire campaign of Bataan on the front lines.
How long a time was that?
It was only a matter of a month or so. And we fought on the front lines until April the 9th of 1942, when Bataan fell and we were captured.
What happened then? Where did they take you?
Well, that's where the I was captured by tanks, and there was only about 10 of us in the group, and I was captured on an ammunition trail leading down into southern tip of Bataan, and about 10 tanks rolled in on us, and we walked out in front of them, certainly expected to be shot, but they turned us over to the troops, which were in back of the tanks. And they loaded their packs on us, and we had to carry their packs for about 5 miles, where we went to the main concentration of prisoners of war, which is southern tip of Bataan. And from there, we started the so-called Death March of Bataan. And there were about 70,000 Filipinos and 10,000 Americans, and they had no provisions for us for water or food or anything, or transportation. And we started the march on the morning of April the 10th. And I was on it about a week. And we hadn't eaten since the night of the 6th. And so I went about 8 or 9 days without anything at all to speak of. 2 canteen cups of rice all the time we were on the march. And that's all the food we got. But we didn't get enough water. They fought us off the water, and so a lot of men died from thirst. And a lot of them died with they had bullet wounds, some of the fellows from the battle. And a lot of them, the feet got sore, and they took their shoes off and walked on the gravel road with blistered feet. And, of course, they didn't make it. And they had cleanup squads coming behind the columns. There were about 500 of us in a group. And if they fell out, they were killed. You either bayoneted or shot. And I was jabbed with a bayonet, but not too severely, probably an inch or so. And I was trying to help a fellow, and the jab guard came along and made me quit by jabbing me with the bayonet. And I lost a little blood, but not a lot. But I can remember how the flies used to follow me because I had blood on my shirt, and it was sore, but I healed up and got all right. We went to a little town called San Fernando after about 65 miles. And there they loaded us into boxcars and took us another 50 miles into Capiz, Tarlac province. And we were loaded there because in the boxcars we were put about 100 to a car and jammed in there, just as many as could stand up. We couldn't sit down. We're just standing up in the car, but there were metal cars, and the heat on the cars made them just like a furnace, and a lot of the men suffocated in the cars and everything. You couldn't get your... You tried to get our nose in a crack where we'd get fresh air, but there weren't that many cracks available. Went to this Capiz Tarlac, and we were unloaded there, and some of the men died in the cars because we were such a weakened condition after Bataan, because we were starving on Bataan. We didn't have a resource. We didn't have any food coming in from the outside, and we didn't have enough stored. And we walked about another 8 miles on into the first prison camp, which was Camp O'Donnell. And there, the Filipinos, there were about 70,000 Filipinos and 10,000 Americans, and they claimed 10,000 died on the march. That's Filipinos and Americans. And the Filipinos were on one side of the fence, and we were on the other. And the death rate of the Filipinos was 500 a day or so. They carried them out, and they just piled them up out in the field. They couldn't bury them fast enough. And the Americans, there were about 60 or 70 a day or more. And I worked on the burial details, and we'd dig big holes and buried just mass graves. And sometimes during the night, the wild dogs would dig up the bodies and scatter them all over the place. And we'd come back the next morning and pick up the pieces and put them in the hole and then bury the men that died. But a lot of times we wouldn't get to them for 3 or 4 days, and in the hot sun and everything, it was a mess. And things were so bad there that they had a detail going out and people could volunteer for it. So I volunteered for it. And there were about 325 of us, and we went to a work detail in the southern tip of Luzon Island in the jungle area, building roads through the jungle. And we marched another 25 miles into this road, and we carried 6 men with malaria in there to work on the road. And a couple of them died on the way in. But we were supposed to be going in there to go into work, and it was a rainy season was starting, and we were in the rain, and we slept in the mud, and we worked 12-hour shifts on the road, and anybody that stood up had to go to work. The guards had come through the camp area, which was just an old riverbed, and anybody could stand up or they'd make you go out to work. And a lot of men died right at the end of a pick and a shovel. I got very sick on the road and finally got where I couldn't even go out to work, and they broke up the detail long after about 3 months. And they took us into a Bilibid prison in Manila. And if I hadn't have gone in there when I did, if I'd have been a week later, I'd have been dead then. But Bilibid prison saved my life. Right after the war started, they captured Cavite Naval Yard, which was the home of the Asiatic Fleet, and there were a lot of Army doctor, Navy doctors, and corpsmen, and they went as a unit into Bilibid, and they tried to help people that were coming in from work details and everything at Bilibid. It was kind of a, we called it a hospital, if you want to call it that. It was a place to come in and die, too. It was a, anyway, you had to be very sick to get any medicine, and I was sick enough to get some. And I got over my malaria, but I was getting very, very awfully bad, which is when you starve to death, that's what you do. The first thing you do is start to swell. And you can't pass water, and all this water goes into your tissues and your system. And my legs were swelling up, and it got up into my body, and I finally, and Christmas of 1942, we got a Red Cross parcel, I remember, and it was made by the American Red Cross, and it had a can of Spam and corned beef and some chocolate bars and coffee and Prim and some other cans and a can of butter and everything. And I took that and I rationed it to myself just a little bit at a time. And I got rid of my beriberi, because the minute our body was so starved for vitamins that any time you ate something with protein in it, why, it would activate. And I finally lost all the water in my system. But you'd go for a week or so without passing water at all, and it'd all go into your system. So when I finally went down, I was as skinny as a crow. I was it was all nothing left but bones, because it takes all the flesh with it when it finally goes out of your system. But anyway, I lived through it, and I was about 6 months in there that I didn't walk in Bilibid prison. And that's when I started drawing. And I, to pass the time of day, and I drew on the floor or anything, and I took charcoal out of the wood fires and worked with that. Finally got some pencils and some paper, and they brought in to start the rice fires, and there's some big sheets of paper, and I got some of those and started drawing on the backs of them, and I completed about 50 drawings.
Did you have to hide it from the
And I guards? Gave them to a Catholic priest, and he put them in the bottom of his mass kit. He had a little false compartment in there that he kept some of his stuff. He used to keep kind of keeping a diary anyway, and he kept my drawings in there. Well, I didn't have anything of an atrocity nature to speak of. They're just normal chow lines and that sort of thing, and prisoners standing around the bed and in the building. And I completed about 50 drawings, which I later lost. But after Bilibid, I stayed in there a year and a half, but that was the best place I was in. I hated to leave the place because I knew it was about the best place to be. So after about a year and a half, which was early 1944, I went to Cabanatuan, which is a camp north of Manila, about 60 miles. And there's a recent book out of it called Ghost Soldiers by Hampton Side that just came out, and it's the liberation of Cabanatuan prison camp and one of the most courageous missions in World War II. The Rangers went in and liberated it. Anyway, I stayed in Cabanatuan about 6 months. And at that time, the Americans were starting to come up and they were coming into the Philippines. They were taking New Guinea and Tarawa and Tinian Island and Saipan and all those places. And they were coming into the Philippines, and the Japanese were taking prisoners of war to Japan. So they were loading ships out of Manila Bay and taking us to Japan. And I sailed out of Manila Bay on the 4th of July of 1944. And we were 2 months aboard this so-called hell ships, we used to call them. And they were just that, because they put us down the holds of the ship and covered the hatches. And we didn't get out of the ship. We were on it 2 months. And we were down the hold of the ship for 2 months. So we didn't wash our face and hands in 2 months. And we were filthy, dirty, and if we got any water, we drank the water. They'd lower buckets down in there for latrines and for rice. And sometimes you were lucky to get some of the rice, because when it was lowered down in the hold, the guys were all hungry, and they'd just kind of take what they wanted. And sometimes it wouldn't get to the guys on the outer perimeter at all. So we went hungry in there. And but we were glad to get off that ship after 2 months, and we landed in Moji, Japan. And when we first loaded, we went out into Manila Bay and anchored for 2 weeks. And then a typhoon came in, and we sailed during the typhoon. It probably saved our lives, because the Americans were blockading the Philippines with submarines, and they had aircraft flying over the place at the time and sinking ships. And they sunk some of the hill ships coming out of there, several of them. And one of them was my drawings. This priest was on this, what they call the Orioka Maru, and my drawings went down with the ship. And so, anyway, he made it back to the States, but he was got on another ship, and they sunk the second one. But he finally got to Japan, and he was one of 160 out of 1,600 to survive the sinkings of those ships. So we call them hell ships. And that's just what they were, because they were unmarked freighters, and the Americans thought they were just freight coming out of the Philippines, so they were sinking them. Anyway, when we got to Japan in September of 1944, they divided the group, and we went to separate coal mines. So I went to what they call Ominamachi, Japan, and they put us to work in coal mines. And when we got to the camp, the camp was had British prisoners of war, which were captured at Singapore, and we were in with them. So half of the camp was British. And we started working this old mine, and this mine was they reactivated it just for prisoners of war, because it was really an old mine. It was from the entrance to the mine to the coal face, one of the places, it was 3 miles. Deep. So you go down in cable cars and get off on different levels and walk through rock tunnels and go to the coal face, and we do that every day. So we'd work 12-hour shifts. We'd go 10 days, and then they'd get a day off, and right during our day off we'd clean up the camp and wash our clothes if we could, and then we'd go 10 nights. So we'd off alter at time to get used to daytime, well then they put you on nights. But I remember we'd get up in the morning to go to work, and we'd have a roll call at 5 o'clock. And everybody was there. You know, if they told you to be there at 5 o'clock, you were there. You know, there were no problems with people sleeping in or anything. Because when they called the roll off, you'd better be there.
What would happen if you didn't?
Well, they'd go into your room, and you'd be a bloody mess, you know. So you'd get beat up if you didn't. So everybody was there. Very few occasions where fellows didn't answer roll call. So I always said I learned a great deal about punctuality in there, and putting it mildly. So to this day, I'm always early, usually, for any appointment.
Makes sense.
Yeah, right. And it kind of stayed with me. I was always the first one to school when I was teaching. And it's something that kind of stayed with me. So I learned a few things about worth ethics and that sort of thing in there. And the Japanese have terrific work ethics. You know, students do and everything else. Well, I learned some of that in there. And it didn't hurt me anyway at all that way. So we stayed there for, we were there a year.
In the mines?
Until the war ended. And the war ended, it came about, I mean, the boss came over, the mine boss, and told us we wouldn't go to work that day. And, of course, that was great news, because we didn't like going down there anyway. And it happened for about 3 days this way. No work in a mine. So there must be something wrong, you know. We didn't know what it was, but thought it could be the war's ended, and we didn't want to believe that and then be disappointed. So finally a B-29 came over and dropped us leaflets and told us about the Japanese surrender, and then we believed it, so there's a big celebration then. And we were so happy to be free again. So they just opened the gates, and all the guards left. And we walked out into the villages, and the Japanese people were afraid of us, you know. They'd all run when we come out of the gates. And we gradually made friends with some of them, though, and gave the, because they dropped us food. They came over with planes and 29s and dropped us tons of food, K-rations and canned fruits and all that sort of thing, and cigarettes, and and candy bars. First thing I got into was a box of candy bars. I ate the whole box, and got sick, of course, and then got in some more bacon, I remember, and I ate some of that and got sick again. But that was no problem. We were used to some of those things, and we ate day and night for several days. And we were so excited we couldn't sleep. So we'd sleep and nap a little bit and then wake up and enjoy our freedom. And eat some more. So that's the way the war ended. We had to wait a month before the troops came in. We had to wait for the occupation troops. We finally got on a train and went out and met the troops because they had to set up processing stations. And so we went to Wakayama, Japan, where they took all our clothes off, and because we were all lousy, and made us shower for 20 minutes. They timed us with medicated soap, and then they sprayed us as we came out, and then issued us new uniforms and fed us and put us on the most luxurious liner you ever saw, the USS Constellation hospital ship, and it had white sheets, and it was, we just couldn't believe this place.
Heaven.
And we were so excited. I remember getting on those sheets at night, and I said, oh, I can't believe this. You know, it had earphone radios and all that sort of thing, and movies on deck, food galore. And the next morning we went through the breakfast line, and it was bacon and eggs, and I went through about four times. And finally I couldn't eat the last I got, so I made a sandwich out of bacon and eggs and wrapped it up, and then I put it under my pillow. And the doctor came around and he says, what do you have under there? I said, what's it? Part of my breakfast took it, and he thought I'd have a lunch after a while. He said, don't worry, we're going to feed you on this ship. He said, you don't have to worry about food anymore. And I said, well, I don't take any chances. You know, when I get an advantage to get food, I hoard it, you know. So he says, you're getting grease all over the sheets, and he says, we don't allow that in here. And you're going to have to, you can't do that anymore. So... And they were getting a big charge out of that because we were a bunch of strange guys. We'd been living this way, you know, like a bunch of reptiles for 3.5 years, and you get kind of used to it after a while. You kind of adapt to most anything, you know, if you have to. But anyway, we went to Okinawa, Japan, and from there they flew us back to the States. And I was in the States, into San Francisco, before my folks even knew I was liberated. And I called them up on the phone from San Francisco, and they almost collapsed, you know, when they heard my voice, because they'd been watching the list of POWs liberated every day, and I wasn't on the list for more than a month, and so they'd kind of given up on me because they hadn't heard from me for so long. To start with, when Corregidor fell, everybody was listed as missing in action, and I was missing in action for about a year and a half. And then a list came out of prisoners of war, and I was on that list. And we used to send little cards out once in a while, you know, that I'm well, I'm not under treatment, and everything, you know, just things that the Japanese wanted to hear. And then we signed them and sent them to the home. So Mother got four or five of those. And when I went to Japan, I said, well, it's cooler here. So they knew I'd been moved. And that was about it. I came back to the States, and I find I was in the hospital for a year, being treated for a lot of different things, psychological problems and all that sort of thing for about a year. I wasn't a bed patient. I was in and out. And then I went to school. I started GI Bill and went to the Cleveland Institute of Art, where I graduated in 1950. I went 4 years in three. I went summers and all the time. And then I went to Kent State University for a year and got some academics and graduated there in 1952 and 51. And then I started my master's degree at the University of Denver, and I met Shirley in the meantime, and I taught high school in her hometown, and we were married, and we went back, and I finished my master's degree in 1953. So I went really 6 years in about 4 or 5, because I went summers. I didn't ever stop. I thought I was too old to be going to school. I was 28 years old when I started. But I like school. You know, it was just kind of a breeze after everything that I'd been through. And there were a lot of GIs in school at that time. It was a big flux of GI Bill students. And then I, after I got through with my graduate degree, I got a job with the Department of Army. So I went back kind of worked with the military again, but I was civil service. And I worked in Kansas and the Pentagon and Atlanta, Georgia, the Third Army. I was a staff crafts director, which is special services in the military, and it's a recreation program for soldiers. And politics were kind of too much for me, so I decided I wanted to go back and get into college teaching. So I went out to Montana, and I went up and saw the president of Eastern Montana College, it was at that time. It's Montana State University Billings now. And they put me on in the art department. And I wound up chairman of the art department. I taught there for about 25 years. And but I didn't start at Eastern until I was about 40 years old, because I'd done a lot of living before that. And I retired in 1986 after about 25 years, and wound up a college professor, full professor, emeritus.
Congratulations.
Yeah. And little did I know I'd ever be a teacher when I was a cowboy back in Montana. I surprised a lot of my family, because I didn't graduate from high school. I was 21 years old, because I dropped out of high school during Depression days to help support the family, really. And took a job at $30 a month, cowboy and a sheep herd, you know, sheep camp tender. So I did that for about 3 years. Then I went back and finished the high school. I didn't quit high school because I wanted to. I would quit because it was kind of a necessity. There were five kids at home, and Dad was making $48 a month. And 15 of that went for rent. Can you imagine that? $15 a month rent. But that left us $33 a month to live on, you know, with five kids. And that's a little tough, you know. So I went out and I sent my money home by $30 a month, which was a big boost to their salary at that time. But you could do a lot with $50 a month in back in 1940, 39, 37, right along there. That's about it.
Do you still keep in contact with some of the buddies you...
Oh, yeah. We have two national organizations. We have the American Ex-Prisoners of War, and then we have the American Defenders of Bataan and Corregidor, which is strictly Pacific prisoners of war.
Okay.
and a lot of them were over there yesterday. And we meet nationally and we meet regionally. So we go to at least two a year. And we have a great camaraderie among us. We claim we understand each other. And it's hard to give people the real impact of something like this. You almost have to live it to really know what it's like. Because it's a different life. And it's their survival rate was not very good off Bataan. It was we had a 60% casualty there due to the death march and everything. But people that survived the first year and a half had a pretty good chance of getting out of there if they weren't sunk on one of the hell ships or died in the mines or something. So the first year and a half is the worst part of it. And after the Japanese started losing the war, they eased up on us a little bit. And I don't know what would have happened if they'd have won. We'd have had rice paddies up and down the Red River. Mm-hmm. That wouldn't have been too good, you know.
A lot different.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Do you have any final thoughts about what you went through serving your country?
Well, I did it because I thought it was the right thing to do. And, you know, if you want to remain free, you got to fight once in a while. Otherwise, somebody has to do it for you. Mm-hmm. So, I'm very patriotic.
Mr. Steele, how would you like to be remembered?
Well, as a man who left a lot of tracks in life, maybe, and helped others.
Huh? Thank you very much, Mr. Okay. Steele.
I guess what I'm really curious about is you said the one ship sunk with the priest and you lost quite a few of your drawings. How did you feel when you found out that news? I mean,
when I heard it?
Yeah, when you heard about it.
Oh, I didn't think too much about that, really. I didn't get out of there with anything outside a couple of sketches that's over in the exhibit. I was glad to get out of there with my hide. And I really didn't expect them to get out with them. So I wasn't too shocked. And I had the ability to do them again. So I tried to remember some of those things and then I just redid them from memory. So all those things are from memory over there. And I've got a lot of memory. I've got lots of ideas if I had time to do them all.
Kind of continuing along that line then, I know a lot of artists almost have to have the object right there in front of
yeah.
them when they sketch it or something, and you pull yours straight out of memory.
Right out of my head.
And that's never been a problem
for I've got kind of a photographic memory. I've drawn places where people say, that's it, you know, and I don't look at it. I just remember it as it was.
So when you draw like a scene of the Bataan Death March or something, is there a specific scene that you can pull straight out of your
sure.
head if something happened?
Oh, I've got a lot of them. No, I didn't do them all, and I didn't do some of the worst ones. But there was a lot of vicious things took place on that march. There was decapitation, there was everything, you know. And I saw a lot of guys killed, you know.
I was really amazed at the detail of your drawings. In their, they're very lifelike. I was wondering, is that kind of a way for you to get it out of your system?
Well, it is. Yeah, they're kind of an emotional release for me. And I've had psychologists say it's one of the best things to happen to kind of rehabilitate yourself. So they've helped me a lot. And they've helped me to talk about it and everything. You know, I didn't used to talk about it too much. I'd draw pictures, but I didn't talk about it. And they've gotten me involved where I talk about it now. Oh. Hello.
So you can kind of think of it as even like a link to your past.
Yeah.
To the whole event that you went, no matter what happens, that is always going to be there.
Yeah, right.
To represent that.
Oh, yeah. I don't forget very much.
I know, speaking from my generation too, who've never gone through anything like that, it's very, you know, surreal to see all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And to have it captured, because there's no way we can ever experience what you guys went through.
You can learn a lot going through that exhibit there of conditions. And those aren't some of the worst things.
How much did the whole... Did you draw before all this
happened? Or? No, I knew of Will James. You ever hear of Will James?
Yes, I have.
Huh?
Yes, I have.
The Western author and writer, Smokey the Cowpony, and All the Day's Riding, and The Lone Cowboy, all those. I knew him. And I used to watch him draw. And that kind of inspired me to pass the time. You know, I think he did it. I probably can do that. But it always seemed to sort of a something magical to me, you know, that I didn't think I'd be able to do that. But anybody can do that, really, to a certain level. You just, if you work at it, if you really get interested, you find a way to do it. It's like anything else, you know.
And then when you went off to school, did you take up studying art right away? Or?
Yeah, I did. I knew I wanted to do that. So I went to a very good art school, a professional art school, which all they taught was art, Cleveland Institute of Art. And I studied under some very famous people.
So your whole experience over there kind of indirectly set forth your path for the rest of your life?
Oh, yeah. I found a profession in there. I'm the only one that did, that I know of. There weren't too many to find in there, you know. Become an undertaker, something like that.
Do you think you would have started drawing if the march would have never happened? If you would have never had to go through all that?
I doubt it. I don't know. I don't know. I probably would. I was very interested in art. I used to like to go through art exhibits and everything. I probably would have started sometime in life.
How do, you said you're a member of a couple other POW groups. How do the other POWs react to your drawings?
Well, they like them. And some of them, I've heard some of them say they kind of make goosebumps stand out on their arms or stuff, but yeah, they kind of encouraged me to do them, you know, to document what we did, because we don't have any other documentation. Like TV last night, they had some of the Death March, and those are in the archives, but I don't know who took those. But the real nitty-gritty of the camps is not documented. The Japanese took pictures, but they destroyed them all. Otherwise, they'd be in the archives.
You said that you shy away from the more gruesome type scenes.
Well, I haven't done some of the more gory things for some reason or other. I guess maybe I didn't want to think about them too much. But I may do some someday. I just recently finished one that's not in the exhibit. It's at home, but I should have sent it with the exhibit, I suppose. I don't sell too many of those for wall decoration. Julie and Rosemary's got quite a gallery of them, but they don't have any of those. I thought maybe they'd ask me for one of those someday, but they don't seem to. It's something you don't want to look at every day. They're museum pieces. Because not all art is beautiful, you know.
Oh, it's not.
Yeah, you got it.
Do you think you'll ever run out of steam of it? And
out of steam?
Get tired of drawing it?
No, I don't think so.
It's still enjoyable for this day.
Not until I die, anyway. It's something I kind of have to do. If I don't paint for a while, I get kind of frustrated. It's something that's in you that has to come out. I paint watercolors and everything now for pleasure. and realistic landscapes. I've got a lot of them floating around. Cowboys, and I love watercolor.
It's a beautiful medium.
It is.
Mm-hmm. Well, the
exhibit, it's a great medium.
Just from what I saw yesterday, the exhibit drew up, you know, for an opening day, a lot of people, you know, especially during the middle of the day. And how does it make you feel to see so many people enjoying your work?
Well, I enjoy that. I've had people say, well, why do you do these things? You know, why don't you do something beautiful? As I do. I'm not entirely gruesome.
Is there a particular piece in your collection that you're especially proud of or that evokes a powerful emotion from you?
Not really. No, they're kind of all equal. Probably, I did the oils after I had training. I did the little pen and inks after I had training, the black and white pen and inks. So they're a little more skillful than the black and whites. I didn't know anything with black and white when I did those. I didn't have any training when I did those. So I enjoy painting and everything now because I understand color and mixtures and all that sort of thing. And I know a lot more than I did when I did the black and whites. They're kind of primitive.
I imagine you've seen your skill grow quite a bit, though, from when you first started drawing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I can draw better than that now. I taught drawing for 25 years, and I learned while I did that, you know. Learned from the students.
I got a lot of respect for anybody that can draw, because I can't.
Yeah, you ever try?
I've tried a lot.
Oh, so yeah. You have to try hard.
We're doing all this kind of stuff.
You can't just doodle around. You got to work at it hard, you know.
We're always drawing storyboards. You
got to draw all
like
day.
And it's all stick people for me. That's the best I can get. Well, man, they're good stick people. So.
Yeah, you have to work at it hard, and you have to learn perspective and all that, which is a science, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, perspective comes into play for this, too.
Yeah, how to put things in the third dimension. How to do three-dimensional color and all that sort of thing.
It's a lot to
But if you like drawing, keep at it and you'll get good.
Be a good skill.
We hope. Students used to say, I've had students that say, I want to draw like you do. I say, well, keep at it. After about 20 years, maybe you can do that.
When you were teaching, did your students ask you a lot about your experience over there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the ones that knew about it. Oh, yeah.
You got it?
No,
it's good. I think we're good.
Yeah.